Welcome to Independence, the FIEC podcast. My name's Phil Topham, Executive Director of the FIEC, and it's time for our regular dive into the news after a three-week hiatus. And with me is our Associate National Director, Adrian Reynolds. Good morning, Adrian.
Good day.
And yes, we'll get to that. And our National Director, John Stevens.
Hi, Phil.
Good morning to you, John.
So that was cultural appropriation.
Well, there we are. Brothers, were you busy last week? Anything on?
I don't know. It's all a bit of a blur. Oh, yes, we had a leaders conference.
Oh, yeah, we were up in Blackpool, weren't we? Of course, that's what we were doing last week. What a fantastic time.
Week before Strictly.
What a fantastic week we had set up in Blackpool. We're very grateful to the Lord.
We did. Lots of prayers that were answered. I mean, we worked hard. We don't mind working hard. We want to put on a good conference for people. We had a great theme. I think the theme of World Mission. One or two people were saying, I wasn't quite sure before I came to the conference how this theme would relate to me, but I've been really encouraged and enthused, challenged by hearing what's going on around the world. It is at the heart of what we are as evangelical believers, is sharing the good news with all the world. So it was a great theme. The Lord was very kind to us. There weren't any major technical difficulties or hiccups. Content was strong. It was a happy atmosphere. It was just good to be together, singing together, learning together, meeting together. And even though it's a short period of time and so much effort goes into it, it really felt like it was a rewarding time. I mean, the Strictly team are in Blackpool for a weekend. We're in Blackpool for 48 hours. I like to think that in the eternal scheme of things, our 48 hours was considerably more meaningful than the Strictly visit to Blackpool. It was a great time.
We don't use the Blackpool Tower either. We use the Winter Gardens.
Yes, bigger. We couldn't fit in the Tower Ballroom.
We did a 24-hour after event as well, John.
Oh, we did. Yeah, we did a 24 hours called Reflecting Heaven, thinking about intercultural church, which was, again, really helpful. I mean, the whole thing was immensely helpful. It was a reminder that world mission and evangelism are absolutely integrally linked. I mean, at one level, the big message was confidence in the gospel and the way that God is at work by his Spirit to draw people to himself. And I think we need to remember that actually most evangelism in the UK now is a cross-cultural evangelism, as we're reaching people either from other sort of ethnicities and backgrounds, but actually also British people who have a totally different worldview. So I think actually it's just really helpful to be encouraged by that. And what we were learning from around the world was actually relevant to the UK as well. But the 24 hours thinking about intercultural ministry, so many of our churches now seeing increasing diversity within the life of the church, or they're in communities that are diverse, maybe even in communities that are predominantly ethnic with other religious groups in them. And to think through what that actually means for church and how we do church, and the small steps that churches can take to make people welcome. I thought a very powerful analogy, picking up on the Strictly Come Dancing, was sort of how we relate to those from other cultures in our churches. There's a sort of a point of, they've come to our party. There's then we dance together, and then there's we become joint hosts of the event. I think that was quite a good way of describing how we're relating to others. And I think lots of our churches are at the you're very welcome at our party stage.
And we're just learning. They do that very well. But we
need to move beyond that in order to welcome people as kind of members of our church from whom we're benefiting as well as whom we're serving and welcoming, and just lots of really sort of good ideas to think through how we might begin to do that. And it's a constant journey. It's not something done overnight. It's a long-term commitment to develop those relationships and that fuller coming together as brothers and sisters.
And if you didn't make it this year, 2025, do plan to be with us in 2026. And I find my diary fills up with stuff.
You get the dates in now, right?
Get the dates in now if you can. So the actual conference is 9th, 10th, 11th of November. Same place in Blackpool. And we've got an add-on event as well with Aubrey Sequeira, who's pastor from Abu Dhabi, and is from the Nine Marks Table, is going to help us think about how to change the culture of church to be more prayerful, which is a key issue for us. The whole topic's on prayer next year. So actually, if you can book that extra day, you know, just book an extra night at the B&B or whatever you're staying at, and it's a very cheap add-on event, I think that would be really worthwhile. So why don't you plan to be with us 9th, 10th, 11th, possibly the 12th of November. We'd love to see you in Blackpool.
I like to think that Shirley might have given this year's conference a 10. I suspect Craig would have given it a 9, but it was a really good and helpful event.
Oh, Strictly Come Dancing. It's a
programme on the BBC.
Is it? We'll get to the BBC in a moment. Just one last thing. A little group went out to do some street preaching in Blackpool, didn't they?
They did. Was at the conference. That's exactly right. Yeah. So a little group went out, and I haven't heard how they got on, but I know they went out and did some street preaching, and we're going to see if we can find a way to maybe even incorporate that into the programme next year. And it's a great way, actually, to take the gospel out. Some of us think it's perhaps a bit old-fashioned and a bit old hat, but actually as society changes and cultures change, some of the things that used to be very effective and have sort of fallen out of use for various reasons proving to be effective again. Mm. Street evangelism and door knocking and that kind of stuff. And so it was good the little team went out. And I think there's an important link there to something the Christian Institute have produced.
Yeah,
this
the Street
week.
Preachers Charter they've launched this week, haven't they?
Really strong document, very helpful, very thorough, very careful, and meticulously researched, as you'd expect, with lots of information for people who do street evangelism. In fact, even those who don't, who perhaps ought to be prompted to think about it, where they are. So yes, just what you can say, what you can't say, you know, where do you cross the boundaries? There are lots of scare stories, aren't they, in the news? You can't say this anymore. This council has banned preaching. And the Street Preachers Charter is really very helpful on what exactly is legal. What are some of the boundaries and limits? Because there are some.
Yeah.
And Christian Institute have done a great job for us by producing that.
We'll put a link to that in the show notes. And brothers, it's on to the next one now. We've talked about next year's Leaders Conference, but Rising Lights is on the, well, the lights are on the horizon, we might say. That was a terrible link, wasn't it? But Rising Lights coming up 6th to the 10th of April. Tickets still available. We enjoyed talking about that last week. Lots of people took flyers away for their churches. We're really excited for that, John.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a great opportunity. We're hoping that sort of thousands of Christians, kids, sort of young people will gather together for mutual encouragement. I mean, there's just that great, but even the Leaders Conference, being together with 1,000 people just lifts your heart and your spirits, and you're able to do things you can't easily do in the local church. We wanted to do that for the benefit of church members, building on what Word Alive has been doing for years, but not being able to continue. We've got, I think, a great program, a great teaching. We're putting together a whole load of other fun activities surrounding that.
There'll be Lego, John. Are you excited by that?
Yeah, absolutely. Whether there'll be a silent disco as there was at Word Alive, I don't know. But
you're excited by that, John, the silent disco, the prospect.
My kids were excited by that and loved it.
That's not answering the question.
No.
I think John will be there. Yeah.
I think a blind disco is the only disco I would go to if nobody was looking at anybody else moving. But cover your eyes. Maybe a masked disco. That's the kind of way to describe it.
Well, there's some ideas there anyway, Adrian. We can build on
but
that.
But it is great. Yeah. And you know, lots of tickets. We'd love people to be there. It's £160 for adults, £40 for kids, £100 for 19s to 24s. Yeah. Loads of accommodation available.
Fantastic. We're looking forward
I'm
to
just
Rising
booking
Lights
in day. My daughter and son-in-law and their kids this Excellent. Week. They're oh, coming
really
along,
good.
Which is good news.
Yeah, that's really, really good. And then before then, last weekend in January, our Journeys Conference for those who are exploring ministry. Right, brothers, let's talk about what's going on in the news. So we have had in this last couple of days all the kind of fallout from the COVID inquiry. The woman chairing the committee has essentially said the government was, they acted too little and too late in terms of COVID. And basically, you could have paid me 200 million quid and I would have come up, I think, with these headlines. I mean, both lockdowns were both avoidable and came too late, which is quite interesting. Would people really have followed social distancing, which would have meant lockdowns would have been prevented? We'll never know. Hindsight's a wonderful thing. But there's lots of lessons here, aren't there, in terms of how you deal with a crisis, how you learn lessons as you go through, how you pivot, change direction, whole host of things to think about.
It's one part of the inquiry.
Yeah, of course. But it's...
So it's the one on decision making and the political decisions, which in some ways is the most interesting to us as we think about leadership lessons.
Correct, yeah.
But there has been a previous module that's already been published and reported on, and there are others to come. So this is the key one about how decisions were made. And you've just given it sort of the populist summary.
I have, which I think that's what
it's my job. The key headline number that's been used is that if the first lockdown had happened a week earlier, then 23,000 lives would have been saved. And I kind of got skin in the game because I lost a relative from COVID. I've lost my hearing from COVID. Mm. So it's not nothing, COVID. Mm. I think that's the first thing to say. And the report's very clear on that. This is a real issue facing the country and a real problem facing the country. And I think it's worth remembering as we talk about this that we said this all the way through, that the government is facing something that was unprecedented.
Yeah, they've not dealt with something like this
before. So there's some clear leadership lessons, and there's clearly some things they made a complete hash of and some other things they got right. We need to say that as well. But they'd never faced anything like this before. Mm. There was no precedent to follow. There was no, 5 years ago we did this, let's do this again. There was none of that. And it was an unenviable position to be in, really. To place restrictions on people of any kind is a difficult thing, I think, for leaders to do. And therefore, we do need to accept some of the criticism and just analyze it and apply it maybe to our own situation. But I think we need to do so with a sense of humility. Mm. I think there is a sense in which it was a very difficult situation to deal with, and we do need to cut people a little bit of slack before we throw everybody under a bus.
Oh no, I totally agree with that. But I think
I wasn't saying you were doing that. I'm just saying that it's easy to do that.
The point I'm making was, if you disagreed, for example, with lockdowns, would you have agreed with the mitigations that would have avoided lockdowns being?
Yeah, I mean,
this is it, isn't it?
The irony is, if you, she's saying in the report that actually if measures had been, not a full lockdown, but if strict measures had been introduced earlier, a full lockdown would not have been necessary. But of course, those who are very, very against lockdown of any kind would not have also probably not have accepted stricter measures earlier on. And that's what I mean by the government, I think, was in an unenviable position.
And hindsight's 2020, so you can look back on this and say, oh, these are all the things that should have happened.
Indeed.
You can't make those decisions in the moment quite like that, can you, John? It's not always straightforward.
It's difficult to make the decisions. As you said, I think the report doesn't find anything surprising that we didn't know anyway. But at one level, that's actually quite significant in and of itself for lots of people who've been wanting to find some smoking gun of some sort of conspiracy or a deliberate attempt on the part of the government to exploit COVID to gain power for itself. There's absolutely nothing of that here. What is indicated is very difficult decision-making in circumstances. Obviously, it was a chaotic decision-making process. So I think what's highlighted is failures in government, failures in the personalities of some of the individuals in government in the way that they were approaching decision making. So it was obviously very difficult for sensible decisions to be made because of the different competing political perspectives and philosophies that were at work. There was an inadequacy of the advice that was provided, failing to take into account all of the implications. There was obviously the challenge of public opinion. There was a lack of preparedness for the possibility of a pandemic. So actually the government had to make these decisions, and it was a dysfunctional decision-making group against the lack of preparation for what was coming. In the light of all of that, the judge doesn't find that there was some sort of terrible conspiracy. She concludes that the actual imposition of a lockdown in March was absolutely necessary. There might have been things that could have avoided it if earlier action had been taken, but the inquiry doesn't find that lockdowns shouldn't have happened. It concludes that some of the consequences weren't properly thought through and recognised, but this is not an inquiry that says this was the wrong decision to be taken at that particular moment. There's a lesson for leaders. Actually, crises will expose the quality of your decision making and your preparation. So if you have no preparation, inadequate information, you're not watching happening elsewhere, and you've got a divided decision-making group, you will not be able to make the decisive decisions necessary. So if you've got a divided eldership that's disagreeing with itself, church that's divided with itself, if you haven't thought about issues that come up, you haven't put in place sensible policy procedures for things like complaints or safeguarding or health and safety, when an issue comes, actually, you won't be able to make sensible decisions. So I think one of the key lessons is the need to be genuinely prepared for what might happen and to make sure that your decision-making processes are healthy and good. Those were wrong in government anyway, and this just, I think, exposed that.
I just want to challenge that a little bit, John, because I think the luxury of thinking about what-ifs is a luxury most leadership teams don't really have. I think of all the leadership teams I've been part of, we spend so much of our time firefighting or dealing with present crises. I think it's very difficult to carve out time to think what ifs. And I don't know how leadership teams do that. So I think there's an ideal there, which is perhaps to be pursued. I accept that. But I think it's very difficult for an ordinary church leader to think, well, I've got to add more time to my elders' agenda, thinking about what might happen. I know we do that in certain areas, mainly because we're obliged to. So we do it in safeguarding, for example. We have safeguarding policies, and those sorts of policies are thinking about, you know, what might happen when. A complaints policy perhaps fits in the same category. But I think it's hard for church leaders to do that. And I think it's hard for government. It must have been hard for government.
Mm. I think that is right. But although I'd push back and say, actually, any organisation has to undertake risk assessments of what they think the possible risks are. There's a difference between the what-ifs you could never anticipate.
Yeah.
But there are actually a whole category of risks that we ought to be taking account of, and it's reasonable to take account of. Government had already been anticipating pandemics, flu pandemics, the possibility that this might happen has been on government agendas for a long time. This is something they ought to have been prepared for. The challenge is that they had only prepared for a certain kind of pandemic, and they had the civil service, it was found, had reassured the government that preparations had been made when they clearly hadn't.
Yes, they were poorly advised.
So the civil service, which was responsible for that, so it's not always the leaders who ought to be responsible for that. You can delegate that out, but the very people who should have been responsible were basically misadvising and hadn't done what was necessary.
Maybe we're making a case here for saying things like risk assessments should be more than just, as they often are in church life, a box ticking
exercise. Absolutely.
They need to be serious consideration. Yeah. And we've just been going through our risk assessment, and the person who's been helping us with that has been helping us to think about, you know, what happens if the money drops off? What happens if there's, you know, a leader has to step down because of illness, or, you know, so we're trying to think of some of the catastrophes, the what ifs. And I think actually we want to make a case for that. I think in so many churches, policies are an afterthought, or people are grumbling about them. You've got to do this. Risk assessments, do we really have to? And the answer is yes, they can be a really good tool for working through some of this stuff. And there's some other leadership lessons as well, I think, Phil. Two of the interesting things for me in the report are both about leaders. One is that the normal leadership processes were put to one side. So the cabinet was hardly ever consulted.
Was that because of a nimbleness that they wanted? Possibly,
but I mean, you've got to have confidence in your system, I think. So, I happen to think that the cabinet model of government that we have at the moment, the way it's operated with such a large cabinet, is pretty unwieldy. I think it needs reforming, personally, but that's a political view rather than any other kind of view. But there is a system. People are department heads. They're responsible for their areas. And so bypassing that in the way they did was criticised in the report, and I think rightly so, because if people aren't involved in decision-making, they don't have an input. So I think we do need to have confidence in our systems. And I think if we start bypassing them, we start getting in trouble. The meeting that happens outside the meeting, once very that dangerous. Happens in your church, you're in dangerous ground. Yeah. The other thing that I think came through clearly is there were people in roles, I'm not going to name names, we all know who they were, who were underqualified or not qualified at all to be in the roles they were in. They just didn't have the competences. And I think certain people are named in the report as being subversive and chaotic and creating toxic environments. And I think it's just a good example of, you know, it's great fun to have people like that in leadership. Someone who's a bit, gets under your skin and willing to shake everything up and, is a contrarian. It can be very exciting and energizing to have someone like that in leadership when things are going well, there's zero risk. But when things get difficult, people like that can be really dangerous. And I think there are reasons that we have all the qualifications for leadership that we do in 1 Timothy 3. And I think it just reminds us that the importance of choosing wise leaders who both have the gifting, so they have the ability, and they have the character to match is a really important principle. And actually, you can get away with appointing leaders who are not in those categories when things are going well, but it's when the chips are down, then that really holds you back.
I think another thing that underlies is the danger of optimism and assuming that things will work out okay.
It won't be
so
as bad as it.
Something that was said here is that there was an undue optimism that the UK would be different and not learning from others. So the comment is made that they should have been watching what was happening in China. They should have been watching what was happening in Italy, which would have brought home to them the seriousness of the situation. But there was an optimism that it won't be the same here. And then the failure to take action off the back of that then meant that harsher action was ultimately needed. So there is a lesson about, I think, not approaching things with an optimistic, it'll turn out all right or won't happen here mentality. In churches, we can easily do that. We might hear of problems elsewhere. We just assume it's not ours. We're different. It'll be different with us. And actually, you can't be naive in that way. All of this is part of the reason why in FIEC, we've produced a raft of template policies for a whole raft of areas of church life, the kind of things that we should be thinking about. Employment, health and safety, safeguarding, social media policies, complaints policies. If those aren't in place, when the problem comes, you won't know how to deal with it. You won't have a way of dealing with it. And it's just sensible anticipation.
Let's move on, talk about something else, because time is going to get away from us. We've seen two high-profile resignations at the BBC in this last couple of weeks. So the Director General and the Head of News have both resigned over a Panorama documentary that was edited to make it look like Donald Trump was speaking more strongly about something than he was. Two parts of a speech spliced together some 50 minutes apart from each other, which made it look like he was saying something that he wasn't. It's very serious, isn't it, in terms of where bias is shown in our news reporting. The BBC has always been this bastion of impartiality, has been effectively caught out on this. And Donald Trump has threatened to sue for somewhere between £1 and £5 billion, which has got something of Austin Powers about it. It's reminded me of the
Quiet
90s.
Piggy.
Pardon?
Quiet piggy.
Yeah. but this is a fascinating story, isn't it? Because we've seen heads roll, and it gives us all sorts of questions, doesn't it, about where's our trusted news source? What does it mean for accountability? How do we deal with cultural failings? All these kind of things, because it doesn't look good for our great.
I mean, it's worth saying, by the way, that the issue is bigger than just the Trump.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's all the stuff over Glastonbury over the summer and other things like that, isn't it?
So there was an internal report that was done that's come to light, which has raised the question about the Trump video editing, but actually is more broadly about bias and about influence and, you know, who's pulling the strings and bias and all those sorts of questions. And that's caused the downfall of both the DG and the head of news, who is essentially being groomed to be the deputy, to take over from the DG. So I think you can probably say the DG and the deputy DG to some extent. Yeah.
John, how do we approach this in terms of learning lessons from it? Because the top guys have lost their jobs. They wouldn't have been directly responsible for what's happened underneath them, but that's where it happens.
They were responsible for seeing the overall editorial line of the BBC.
But they wouldn't have been involved in editing that. They wouldn't have put that out.
The question is not just the particular distortion of a speech in Panorama. It's actually the whole editorial approach of the BBC and whether or not it actually reflects a diversity of opinion. So they are responsible, I think, for setting that overall tone of the BBC
and the culture,
and where it's pitched. The criticism is not just specific stories, but that the BBC as a whole tends to reflect only one perspective on stories, and that runs through much of the corporation. It's affected its coverage, for example, of transgender is another area that's been picked up. Having said that, of course, how do you accomplish a lack of bias? So actually the BBC, although we talk about it being unbiased, in its foundations, it was biased from the beginning. Lord Reith's agenda of educating the people. It was always designed to promote a particular way of thinking that was seen to be in the national interest. So actually, I think this idea of how do you accomplish a sort of lack of bias, it's more complicated than that. And how do you present anything? Everybody has a view. So the challenge with the BBC is it seems to have now skewed to reflect only one particular sort of perspective that seems to dominate. The only way that you can avoid that kind of bias is to have a multiplicity of voices that are speaking and different perspectives being heard, rather than having sort of one line that is adopted as the only position that's presented. But this is a problem with all media outlets. Most media outlets now are speaking not objectively, but they're speaking from a particular perspective that they and their owners sort of hold. And it's very difficult to find any objective source that is actually reflecting the diversity of views. And people now, they feel something is biased if it simply doesn't say what they want to hear and what they believe.
It's always been like that though, isn't it? Is that really that different from how it's always been?
Well, I don't think it is that different. I think what's different now is you can choose the source that you want. You can get access to that quite easily, and then social media algorithms push the same kind of things into your in-tray, as it were, so that you kind of see the same opinions. I think there's a piece of work to be done in terms of how you read different sources. What does that wisdom look like there? Do we instinctively know what line a particular media organization is going to take? How do we read it?
30, 40 years ago, you didn't go out and buy the Daily Telegraph. Or if you did, you read it knowing it was not your position. And if you were right-leaning, you wouldn't have gone out and bought the Guardian because you knew it wouldn't. So I wonder if what we've done in more recent years is try to impose on outlets like the BBC a burden they just can't bear. So, you know, you get this sort of ridiculous situation where you have something that 95% of the country would agree with and 5% wouldn't, but you have to find someone who represents the 5% to retain editorial balance. And I wonder if it's as much the fault of us as consumers not being so discerning. lacking that skill of discernment and understanding what we're reading and being able to read between the lines. I wonder if that's the thing that's really undermined.
I think that's what I'm saying. Okay. So we do need to discern what we're reading and understand how we read things from different viewpoints and where we get the truth from that rather than an ideology that's perhaps being imposed.
I mean, I do love the BBC, but
it's still one of the most trusted news site in the world, isn't
it? But the things about it that frustrate me. So I do think that over the years, news has turned into entertainment.
Yeah, yeah, in an unhelpful way.
Oliver Postman was absolutely right, entertaining ourselves to death.
Yeah.
And I think the news is not reported. So much of the news programmes are basically asking people for their comment and their opinion.
Yes.
Whether that be celebrities, whether it be pundits, whether it be people on the street. What you're not getting is the actual news of
and
what's
happening.
And
big stories get missed, like Sudan.
Absolutely. And the world coverage is sort of way less than it was. But again, I'm sure part of this is commercial pressure that actually the BBC is under pressure to deliver ratings. And so therefore you are not distinctive from all the other media outlets which do that. And I think there has been a decline in the actual presentation of news and telling us the stories in favour of comment, often by people who don't really know very much about it. And it doesn't add anything greatly to it.
When I worked as a journalist, there was a buzz phrase that was always pushed on us at the beginning, which was, you need to be giving news people can use. News you can use. Well, it just speaks into exactly what you've just said. It wasn't just the news. It had to be of use to people. Otherwise, it shouldn't make it into your bulletin. And that even there is a bias, isn't it?
It is.
I mean, several lessons for us. I think for those of us who are leaders, if you do want to get an objective perspective or try to have that, the only way you can do that is read across the spectrum of different opinions. You have to read things that don't agree with what you think. You don't
Is that true in your sermon preparation, for example?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that news media, I will read every day the Telegraph, the Times and the Guardian to try to get a perspective from different angles. Actually, I find myself agreeing with different ones of them on different days. And I find myself challenged by doing that. If I'm preparing a sermon, I will read a variety of commentaries and I will read solidly evangelical commentaries. I will usually read another commentary that's not necessarily from that perspective. And sometimes it has insights that I find really helpful. Sometimes they're more honest with dealing with the text because they're not trying to justify a theological position. I just think that listening to a variety of voices is hugely helpful to you. It exposes what your biases are. Mm. And then I think when you're preaching and teaching, of course, at one level, presenting the truth of the gospel, we are biased because we are presenting that. But you've got to be very careful not to bring in all your own personal biases and add them on top of that and then use the scriptures to justify that. We have to be quite self-critical and careful. And I think that's a really important thing to work hard to try not to just be preaching our own particularly biased perspective on public events or politics or whatever, and work hard to make sure that it is the truth of the scripture that we are declaring.
There was an infamous moment, wasn't there, with the BBC a few years ago now, where someone who'd come in for an interview was put on a stool in the BBC News studio as an IT expert. And I think the irony is that's where the news has got to, that people from the street are being, touted. And there was a great meme going around saying next person to be interviewed for the Director General of the BBC, and it was the picture of the man in the studio looking a bit bemused.
Yeah. Very good.
We need to be exposed to voices that don't that are more on the margins, that need to be heard and need to be taken into account. That doesn't necessarily mean that that's agreed with or given equal weight, but it's vitally important.
Right, John, I want you to give us 90 seconds on Northern Ireland. We'll get to sport. But I want you to give us 90 seconds on Northern Ireland. So this is a judgment from the Supreme Court that has basically said the way religious education is taught in Northern Ireland is unlawful, again, because of its Christian bias, if we're talking about bias. How should we respond to this as believers? What do we need to know here, John?
Well, I think this is actually a massive decision. It's really important that we understand it. It's a decision of the Supreme Court basically saying the way that Christianity has been being taught in some Northern Irish schools is contrary to the European Convention on Human Rights and conflicts with parents and children's religious liberties. At the essence here is the way that Christianity is taught in schools. We're talking about state schools here, not schools that are run by the church. They were church schools, but the church gave them to the state in the 1940s. So they are state schools. They've got an obligation obligation to have predominantly Christian worship in the school and also to provide religious education. The problem is that parents complained and the courts ultimately found that the way that religious education was being provided was in a form that they would describe as indoctrination. In other words, it was actually teaching people to be Christians, not teaching people about Christianity. Indoctrination sounds like a kind of a hard word. Actually, in the judgment, they say that's just a legal term and it's describing what we might call evangelism or proselytism. And the objection was that religious education, what you might call religious education lessons, were not being taught in an objective, critical and pluralist way. So people were simply being taught Christianity as truth. It also pervaded into more of school life. So not just the worship acts, although they're meant to be predominantly Christian, they were actually entirely Christian. So nobody was ever invited in from any other religious perspective. And in other aspects of church life, teachers and others were basically, in a sense, assuming the truth of Christianity and getting the children to engage with it. So, for example, in a school where they were having a snack, the teacher was praying and saying grace before the children had the snack and was encouraging them to do that. And the court basically felt all of that goes beyond merely instructing about Christianity. So the court is absolutely clear. This is not about secularism in schools. It's not about not teaching Christianity in schools. It's not about undermining Christian worship in schools. It's not about what parents do in their home. It's about the way that religious education is provided that needs to be reflecting not just a Christian perspective, but a pluralistic approach. And actually, I think this reflects the growing secularism in Northern Ireland, that these curriculum was set something like 30 years ago. And obviously at that point, Northern Ireland was overwhelmingly a kind of a sort of Christian culture. Now there are far more ethnic minorities, lots of people who become secular and not involved with church. So that what's being done in these schools doesn't reflect necessarily what lots of the parents and the children might reflect. So I think this is a massive question. In the public square, in a kind of a state context, is Christianity to be taught as the truth that everybody ought to sort of follow? That's a kind of a Christendom model of how to operate. And basically, the court is saying, in a pluralistic context, you can't do that. There's a place for Christian worship within the school and parents can withdraw from that. But actually, there's also, if you're going to be instructing in religion, you need to be instructing on a broader basis than that.
An attack on Christianity?
Well, it's not really an attack on Christianity. In a sense, the judges want to make absolutely clear that that is not what they're doing. It is saying that the curriculum and how it's being applied in Northern Ireland doesn't serve the needs of all children in a pluralistic kind of context. It affects nothing at all of what churches can teach, what parents can teach, what we can do outside of a school context. It simply says you can't run school, a state school, as effectively an evangelistic
enterprise.
But
if I'm turning up on Sunday morning to preach to my congregation and there's someone in the church there, they are thinking, and I might be thinking too as a leader, this is another nail in Christianity. Yeah. You know, this is another win for secularism. Mm. You know, secularism won, Christianity nil. Or secularism 3, Christianity 0 again. Isn't that the case?
Well, only if you think the job of the school is to proselytize children who come from non-Christian backgrounds. So that is a whole model of what kind of society you think we ought to have. The judges are at pains to say that that's not what they're trying to do. They're trying to deal with the question of, here you've got a school with people from a variety of different backgrounds. It's all about respecting parents' beliefs. Would Christians want their children to be sent into a school context and basically taught that another religion is the true religion and taught how to practice it without really the option of withdrawing from that? So if you had a Muslim teacher, perhaps they were kind of, you know, holding Muslim prayers in their school outside of that context. So I think I don't think it's a deliberate attack on Christianity. It is a recognition that we are not, in that sense, a Christian country in the way that things were in the past, and a differentiation between religious education and what is effectively evangelism, teaching Christianity. So it doesn't stop the teaching of Christianity. It doesn't even stop the Christian acts of worship, because parents can withdraw their children from that. The problem here that was that this Christian approach was so pervasive through all of the schools' activities, both in the lessons and outside of them, that the judges concluded that it wasn't really possible for a child to exercise their legal right to be withdrawing from those. So you've got a legal right to withdraw from acts of worship and religious education. But in this instance, the whole way that the environment was operating meant that that wasn't sufficient, they felt, to protect the rights of children. And it's a state school. If you go to a church school, you get what you expect. You're right, some Christians will respond in that way, but actually churches are also full of teachers. And we have, for example, even in our church, somebody who's working as a chaplain in a school. These are the things that they're navigating all the time, having to be very careful about. Northern Ireland's been a bit different. I mean, in the rest of the UK, which has been secular for much longer, these are issues that teachers teaching education have had to wrestle with, be careful of.
Brothers, time has gone. John, thank you for being so wise and helping us think about that. When we started the podcast, Australia was 7 down.
Oh, it's cricket. I thought you wanted to talk about NFL.
So we will just mention that. It's an Ashes winter. 17 wickets at the time we started recording have already fallen today. It's not going to go to 5 days, is it, John?
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, whether it's going to go to 2 days, I don't know. I woke up this morning and listened to it, and I thought England had lost the Ashes at the point at which I turned the radio on.
Yeah,
and then at this point, I'm thinking, no, this is going to be a great contest.
Cricket, you heard it. It's like Richie Beno has come back to life.
So I want to say for weeks, this podcast, Bolton has featured rather a lot.
Regularly.
Football has featured. Yeah. I am now in my element. Yeah. So, yeah, I'm going to take over.
It's an Ashes winter, and you'll be hearing more
from
John on that. in the next couple of weeks. Brothers, time's gone. Thank you for joining us to talk about what's been going on in the news. Hope it's been helpful to you as you've tuned in. It's been good to be with you again, and we look forward to speaking to you again soon. God bless.